Hello and a very Merry Christmas from Studio One here at Monocle 24. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly Christmas Special with guess who? Me, Tyler Brûlé.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
It's a very special day for many around the world, and so Andrew and I will be celebrating by bringing you a bumper edition of the Weekly. Andrew, what's in your sack this Sunday?
Well, we're going to start with a masterclass in hygge by welcoming back Trine Hahnemann to the show. The Danish food writer and chef gave a taster in the art of living cosily earlier this year. And she's back now with some more festive Kringle, and she's ready to mingle.
Looking forward to that. We'll also be following up with some of the best wines to go with your Christmas dinner. Kathleen Burke, wine connoisseur, will be providing some expertise a little later.
And there's music too. Later in the show, we'll be joined by Grammy-winning British jazz pianist Bill Lawrence.
And we'll be hearing from Golden Globe and BAFTA-nominated actor Jason Isaacs. The star of films such as Harry Potter and The End of the Affair will be telling us about his new Netflix hit, The OA.
Plus, a look back at the year's best buildings with Peter Murray from the New London Architecture Centre. And we'll find out which far-flung cosy nook you should be headed to for New Year with Eva Kaldic, co-founder of home exchange service Behome.
Sounds like a cracker, Andrew.
And not a turkey in sight.
That's all coming up over the next 2 hours on the Monocle Weekly Christmas Special, right here on Monocle 24. So, loads to get through. Amazing that we've both made it here on a Sunday. I'm very happy that the company went for chartering of a private plane to get us back to studio here in London.
It was very generous of them, and I'm very pleased to see our sledge tied up outside for later on as well, for a quick escape.
Tell us about your Christmas Eve, Andrew.
Well, it was rather good because it's my birthday.
That's
how about
right.
That?
Listeners, you know where to email them.
Christmas and birthday greetings are welcome at this time of year.
So how do you feel about that? Did you ever sort of lobby the family to say, can we just move my birthday to June 25th?
No, I laid down some very early rules as a five-year-old, making it explicit in the contract with my parents that there was to be two gifts. They couldn't get away with one. Various relatives tried, but they didn't get away with it. It was quite good that you were always at home on your birthday. You were always, you know, off. You could always do what you wanted. You didn't have to go to school.
No.
But apart from that, it's not the best day, but I was all right. Later on, it was a bit annoying when your parents actually forgot it was your birthday because they were so busy with Christmas.
Speaking of hygge, and we'll be talking to Trine Hahnemann a little bit later, you already had a bit of a sort of a pre-sort of hygge moment. We finished our February issue, sent that off to press, and off you went to Copenhagen.
Off to CPH, yes. I think what's interesting is how many people in our office have gone, and simply because we've done this great guidebook to the city. So many people proofed it, read it, were involved in writing it. And out of all the guides we've done, it seems to have inspired more people to kind of actually go to one of the places that we've covered. So, and it's selling like crazy. So Copenhagen is obviously of the moment.
It is of the moment. And it was great during the Christmas market. Our Carlotta Rivella, one of course, the regular voice around these microphones, and one of our producers, said she was doing one of the Copenhagen walks and bumped into four other couples and groups who were doing the exact same walk with the guidebook open on a Saturday some weeks ago.
I think there's something about that city. It's you're just struck by how much good architecture there is. The design stores are amazing. And there's a real sense of it being wintry and Christmassy and cozy. It's great.
And it's Christmassy in here. I've got a very lovely spiced apple juice, which is just perfect. Good warm-up, because obviously we do have a lot of wines coming up as well, which we're very much looking forward to. But a good week sort of to ease into the holidays?
Yeah, so the next week is obviously kind of an interesting time, and I'm going to be ducking around the country a little bit. But I think it's just great to have had a good Monocle Christmas, had a great end of year. We've done so many good things this year. So I think everyone's ready to be festive.
I hope so. And it's, yeah, as we've got a fantastic lineup, etc. Any top gifts so far? I mean, I know we were talking a little bit, week before last, though, when we had, I guess it was Midori House. Well, it was only 2 days ago, in fact. We were saying that a lot of your Christmas present shopping, and I was sort of a bit of a sort of a casual observer, a lot of it was just seemed to be for Andrew Tuck. So I'm wondering, did any of that actually sort of end up in the stockings of others?
No. We went,
Andrew!
We were in Tokyo. We brought some very nice pieces of ceramic, and I did contemplate giving them to other people. The trouble is, they were so well packaged, and I began to open them. They had very nice labels explaining the stories of all the potters. I was like...
Didn't happen.
No, I think they better go on my shelf.
No, I thought, before we broke as well, I sent sort of two boxes to Italy. They were all sort of gifts, but part of it as well is, like, you know, you're sending sort of things back from the Tokyo office, and our poor sort of staff have to sort of wrap everything up and send it back to London. But the Japanese just do packaging so well, and not just the wrap things, but the amount of shopping bags I sent back. I love what they did at Isetan this year with all of these, almost these portraits of wolves and owls, yeah, and different animals that really sort of defined their whole Christmas brand program. And I think that's one of the great things about that store as well, is they really treat that 3 weeks of selling as, I mean, aside from being a unique experience, it becomes a whole separate branding exercise for them.
We went down to the food hall, obviously, together, and Tom Reynolds was there. And
watching Baumkuchen being wrapped.
Yes, and all these amazing kind of seasonal treats. It was... odd to be in a country that's not very Christian in a way, but it does Christmas better than many other places.
Indeed. Well, we've got, as I said, tons to listen to, tons to sample and taste. And I think we might have a little bit of a visitor coming up. Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump and rock. All right. Henry, oh Henry, love the way Texas hop. But how am I doing now? Well, what an intro for our very own Henry Reese Sheridan, who is here. Ladies and gentlemen, you just missed almost the clatter of a fine Spanish glassware, but nothing broke in the studio. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Tyler.
You're welcome.
I appreciate the little
thanks
amendment.
Thanks, Andrew, as well, though.
Thanks, Andrew, as well, of course. I appreciate
Merry
the little...
Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas to you,
Merry
Andrew.
Christmas to you. I like the Christmas sweater.
Thanks very much. Thanks.
I like the Christmas shave.
Do you?
Yeah. Did you get a new razor for Christmas?
I didn't know. I use an electric clipper because it does get quite kind of thick up there, as you know from seeing me.
I do, but it seems like it's got better than even a 0.5, because I think 0.5 is kind of as low as you can normally go clippers.
I go straight in there with the raw blade.
Oh, the raw blade.
I'm not sure if that's a technical term,
right,
but it's how I'm going to refer to it.
Well, it's looking good. It's
thank
looking
you
good
very much. A little bit more aerodynamic going into the new year. You know how it is.
Any good Christmas gifts?
Plenty. Plenty back home in Swansea, although we have three dogs. So a lot of the energy in terms of gift acquisition and also in terms of where the finances go towards them. My four sisters and I are sometimes impoverished in that regard. So
were there any sort of dog bags involved?
Oh, there's always...
Not poop bags, but like...
No, stockings.
You understood.
Dog stockings.
I wasn't thinking dog stockings. I was thinking as dog carriers. Or are these quite large dogs?
Oh, no, these are big dogs.
They can't go around in a pram.
No. And they're transported in... They're also quite lively. So we actually have to use boxes. What do you call them?
Cages?
There's got to be a lock in it.
Crates.
Exactly. It's
not... Dog crates.
Yeah. Tyler, I've got the idea that a cute dog in a pram in Tokyo is not the same as seeing someone walking down Swansea High Street with a dog in a pram.
No,
that's a
not.
Crazy person.
Yeah, it would.
It's an altogether different context.
Yes. If you have a very small dog and you do want to carry it around and you're male, again, and you can sort of get away with it if you've sort of got a Tory Burch style sort of dog bag in Tokyo. But if you're a guy and you want to look butch carrying your dog around, already a difficult concept right there. But we did find for one of our lovely clients, Porter does a fantastic dog carrier. Cordura, very nice.
I saw, and maybe you two will be able to help me out with a query I have. When I was in Zurich, flying back from Zurich, I saw in the departures lounge, past security, a lady with a very handsome, very small dog that I presume she was going to take on the plane.
Yeah, European carriers, there's quite a few of them, are actually a lot more consenting to you having a dog on board if you buy a ticket. So Air France used to famously allow people to take miniature dogs, and if you booked a seat, you could sit next to you.
Really?
Yes.
That's, you've answered my question. Thank you very much.
But you do really hope that your dog has gone to the bathroom before it gets on the plane.
Well, that's what I was thinking. There's all sorts of complications, aren't there? Certainly need a sturdy bag, at least,
yes,
to keep it in during the flight.
Now, are we just going to be talking about dogs, or do you have a bit of a news sort of look ahead, you know, next 7 days,
you know,
a little bit further out?
It's a festive season, Tyler, but there's still plenty going on in the world. And I'm going to begin by talking about something that's going on that's very important on January the 1st, 2017, which is the UN Secretary General handover, going out Ban Ki-moon, who obviously
Korea
has
out,
been...
Portugal in.
Exactly, South Korea out, Portugal in. And coming in, Antonio Guterres, he was a former Prime Minister of Portugal. Now, Ban Ki-moon is leaving a checkered record, I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
He is considered to be good in terms of some more culture wars-ish, symbolic
You don't need
things.
To be diplomatic, just say it.
Okay, gender equality and LGBT rights, good. Conflict avoidance, which, let's face it, is what a lot of people will view as being the primary function of the UN. Not so good, mainly because there's quite a big and ugly blot on his copybook, which is, of course, Syria. Now, Antonio Guterres coming in is obviously going to try to reappraise the UN's approach to this problem, but his job is going to be altogether more complicated because of another change in hands of power happening in the United States.
Mr. Trump.
Indeed, who's going to come in and it looks like somewhat upset the world order.
Now, do you think if you were actually a secretary at the UN, it could get confusing when you're at parties and people say, what do? You could say, I'm a UN secretary. I'm the UN secretary.
Definitely.
That'd be quite good. You could pass yourself off without lying, couldn't you?
A few glasses of Prosecco in.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. That's the UN secretary.
Also, I just want to point out, January the 1st handover.
Mm.
That's brutal.
It is.
Presumably, Ban Ki-moon's going to smash it on New Year's Eve because it's going to be the first opportunity that he's going to have had to do so in a long time.
Do you think that, is it a proper handover or is he already back in Seoul?
Well, I know that the swearing in of Antonio happened a couple of weeks ago, so I'm not sure how much more pomp and ceremony there is to it. You know, I wouldn't hold that much hope if I was Antonio.
Do you think there's a little bit like, this is my favourite pen pot. Now, in this drawer, what I like to keep in here.
Definitely.
I think that would be a nice handover.
Definitely. Just let them know where the keys to the drawer is, you know.
One more quick one. Yeah, anything else? Anything else for us? That's it.
Oh, no, there's plenty more going on.
No, you're only allowed one more. We've got
everyone's winding you up in the glass beyond. Come on, hurry up.
I'm going to give you one more. This is important. It's the Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, is going to be visiting Hawaii on the 27th of December. And more importantly...
Oh, that's an important trip.
Yeah, he's timed that well.
Yeah.
More importantly, visiting Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
The first that is important. Japanese leader to do so. Yeah. Altogether more symbolically potent, even more than it would be normally, I think, coming as it does in the final weeks of Obama's term as president. Obama, of course, has worked extremely hard to cement the Japanese-US relationship, particularly in terms of maritime cooperation over the last 4 years.
Just quickly, here's what I want to know. Is it literally Japan Air Force One touching down and then heading straight back to Haneda, or... is he making this a bit of a one-week golf trip?
I think there might be a couple of rounds in there on the links,
yeah.
Tyler. I wouldn't be surprised.
I'll send him the Honolulu guide that we've done as well.
Excellent.
Well, Henry, thank you very much for joining us.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
Merry Christmas.
Go and have a little bit of eggnog on me. Not actually on me. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly Christmas Special. In a moment, we'll be cozying up with Danish food writer and hygge specialist Trine Hahnemann.
Well, the last time Trine Hahnemann was here a few months ago, the author of Scandinavian Comfort Food, Embracing the Art of Hygge, left us wanting more of the region's cozy charms. So we've turned the lights down low. It's almost candlelight in Studio Andrew, but we've invited her back.
And for those who missed hygge first time round, it's the Danish word that describes a sense of comfort and contentment, a condition often achieved through the simplest of pleasures. And to start us off this Christmas day, Trine has brought some typically hygge Danish pastry treats with her. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
God jul.
Thank you. Glædelig jul.
Glædelig jul. That's all I can sort of... Yeah. I'll do the Swedish version for you.
Yeah.
Nice to see you. We have a kringle in front of us.
We do.
And we were making kringle just 2 days ago in Italy. Very, very important with our family. A little bit further down the Baltic in Estonia. But it all looks the same, and I'm sort of like I'm very excited to dive into that because I know that my grandmother is going to be calling me afterwards, and she's going to want to know how did the Danes do it versus the Estonians.
I think you need to tell us what a kringle is for those of us who are not so steeped in the Nordic world.
Sorry, Andrew, you've had our kringle before, though. Don't sound like
I know, but there
anyway.
Are some people around the world who haven't had a kringle. Tell us what a kringle is.
A kringle is a kind of bread cake made out of a dough where you use yeast, butter, sugar. And then you put something in it that will makes it really creamy and tasty. And this time, because it's Christmas, it's almonds and raisins.
So is it a little bit like the Nordic equivalent of a stollen?
You could say that, yeah. But a little bit more
bready.
Oh, much better, of course, of course. Without a discussion.
Well, we're going to start carving that up in a second. But tell us, it's been an extraordinary year for brand Denmark and what people think about the Danes. And we were just saying, I've just been to Copenhagen and we've done a guide to Copenhagen. It's selling, you know, in comparison to other cities that are big cities, it's selling so fast. There feels to be a real moment for the city. What do you put that down to?
I think the world right now is just looking for places where it seems people have figured it out, and somehow it seems to be the Scandinavian countries right now. So that's one thing. And then, of course, there's the design. All the Danish design is being rediscovered. And then you have the restaurants. And then I think it's the bicycle culture, all about the renewable energy. So you have a lot of things combined in one, that Copenhagen kind of, you know, ticks these boxes. And then, of course, it's a very cozy city. It's fun to visit right now, even though it's cold. There's lots of outside, you know, activities. There's lights everywhere. There's the hot red wine, the glögg, or every. I mean, it is just, we get really serious about Christmas. So, but I mean, I lived there all my life, so I find it both very fascinating, and I'm very proud that we reached this stage.
But it's incredible how the Danish cycle keeps rolling, because, you know, if we look back at sort of the rediscovery of modernism, that takes us back to, I mean, really the early 90s, I think, when it really started to take off. So that was like one wave. Then, as you said, then we've had probably architecture came next, the next wave there. And then it went to, arguably, was it sort of bicycles or was it the food movement? And then on food on so many levels.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, obviously we've had the very high, you know, and certainly what, you know, Noma and all of the offshoots have brought the world. But I think what I love about this is I'm all for Noma. I think it's great. But, I mean, I just want a good meatball and I want a good smørrebrød and I want the real Danish experience.
Yeah, you can say that home cooking is our food culture. Restaurant is the new thing. That's, you know, something that happened along with Noma. And therefore, you know, all these other small places and food halls and all the other things you can experience there, I think is a very important part of it, because we are all about home cooking still. Now, and we love cakes.
Now, there's obviously a fun Christmas side to food, but you've done many things in your career. One of them is this notion that everybody deserves a good meal.
Yeah.
You've really kind of worked for the idea that, you know, food makes people live better, improves their quality of life. I mean, seeing in cities all around the world, in nations all around the world, a kind of a breakdown of the link between farming and how people eat, a breakdown between knowing what we can eat and how fat we get and all these sorts of things. Where do you sit in that world? What are you trying to achieve with food?
I mean, I have a company, I feed people for lunch every day. So I work really closely with farmers and producers locally. And I think being connected to nature through food is a very important part. But I also think culturally, I think it's a very important part for people. I mean, when we have people coming from other countries to live with us, I think one of the best things is to invite them to sit down and eat with them. People you eat with, you get to know them, you think different of them. So I think both the food and the meal can be used on so many levels to make sure that we connect with each other.
And how are you doing that, you know, for example, in Copenhagen? Do you invite people into your restaurants, or is it through training people in the kitchens? How are you making the connections with potentially people who are newly arrived to Denmark and maybe don't actually feel that Danish in a way?
I mean, right now I run a project with Syrian refugees where I cook together with a group of young Syrian men, and then we invite Danes and Syrian families to sit down and share a meal. And this is an ongoing project, which is like, you know, we go to communities and we try to, use the meal as a way for people to meet each other. And then, of course, in my company, I have people from all over the world working, and we cook all kinds of food, but with seasonal, regional, Nordic ingredients. So in that sense, we mix it on a lot of levels.
Mm. There was a piece, I believe it was the New York Times, when sort of the whole hygge boom.
I'm going to do a little bit of carving.
Yes,
while
that's the wax paper in the background. But Trina, there was this discussion about hygge being politicized, and could newcomers to Denmark embrace it? And it's seen as a little bit bourgeois, etc. And there was they were setting up a little bit of an argument. And I'm wondering, is there something which is exclusive about it? I mean, I know my answer. I don't think it is. I mean, you know, it comes down to good lighting and having this sort of just sense of, of understanding how to define an environment. Nothing needs to be exclusive about that. But yet, has it become a bit of a debate in Denmark, or is it just the media, do you think?
It's the media outside Denmark. I think the Danes don't really get this discussion at all.
No.
Because if there's one thing Hygge is, it's very egalitarian.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my grandparents were real working class people, and Hygge played a huge role in their life. And I think a lot of times you can actually, you know, come up with examples where Hygge is like anti-commodity, anti-spending money and things like that, because Hygge can be done with nothing. I mean, you need a candle and a cup of coffee and the right people, and it would be hyggeligt right away. So I think maybe one thing it could be is that Danes are not that, you know, it can take a little longer to get to know a Dane.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you, you know, become friends, it's for life.
Oh my God, this is so good. And it's, and it's still warm. How nice is that?
Amazing.
Now tell me, yeah, we've talked about, there have been so many books about being Danish and what Danish means in recent years. This notion of Hygge, was it discussed in this way like 10 years ago? Was it something that felt very present in your lives? Or do you think that there is a kind of a, someone's made it into a bit of a trend? Were you that aware of it 10 years ago?
Not as we're talking about it now. Mm. But the whole issue here is that Hygge for us, it's much more a word that's part of our daily language that we use constantly.
Mm-hmm.
We use it to define all these little moments and pauses and breaks during the day where you kind of feel in the moment, I would say. I mean, Hygge, and I also think maybe this has a lot to do with all the social media we discuss all the time. I mean, five people sitting around a table on their phones, that wouldn't be Hygge.
Never.
Never. Right. Like, it is about that, you know, being present.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'd said to me 10 years ago there were going to be so many books about Hygge coming out, I would probably not have believed you. But I think all cultures have it. I just think because we have still such a strong home culture in Denmark, we still celebrate it much more because we do live at home. Our homes are so important no matter where and what part of society you are.
Andrew, I wonder if there is something within all of this. We've done the story on Tracht in Germany, and you see this revival of dirndls and lederhosen. You know, some would probably go to the extreme and say, oh, this is nationalism and this is over the top. But do you think it is a reaction to, yeah, contemporary forces as well? Because people just feel, you know, we've got these wonderful assets within our own country. These need to be pronounced.
I think it's a really interesting balancing act. And it's fascinating to see how you're bringing people into the story of being Danish. But I think that, yeah, lots of people in different countries, and it doesn't have to be a story that sits on the right, it doesn't have to be nationalist. People want to feel connected to place, whether that's their city, their village, their home. And I think there has been a little bit of a renaissance in saying, actually, let's not let go of all our kind of Bavarian traditions, our Austrian traditions, our Spanish traditions. These are what makes us feel a little bit special in a very globalized world. And let's hold on to them. And they don't have to be exclusionary. And it's funny when you go to Scotland and you see people wearing kilts who are Japanese or who are Korean. And I don't think any Scot feels offended by that. They actually quite like the fact that people want to get on with...
You were almost in a kimono in Tokyo 2 weeks ago.
I would have been if we had stayed in that bar much longer. But anyway. But do you think the same? That?
Yeah, I think in a fast-moving, very, very exciting global world, I think it would be great to celebrate all these regional differences, but of course in a very inclusive way.
Mm.
I think that's very important to say, this is our culture right here. We've done this for hundreds of years. Come share it with us.
And do you think that the Danes have... It's funny, the friendly jostling between Sweden, Norway, Helsinki, the Finns, and Denmark. Denmark's only got a bit of a charge on everybody else at the moment. Do you think they look across and think, oh, hold on, we used to have a little bit of that cozy story?
I think we're really, really excited about being leading the way right now for the first time ever. You know, we have a lot of battles going on. There was a lot of, you know, changing borders over the last 1,000 years. So, yeah, I think we're going to enjoy this moment.
And just tell me how the cookbook has been doing. So the cookbook is called Scandinavian Comfort Food. And it's been serialized in newspapers. You've had a huge amount of publicity around it. Lots of people want to write about it. How's it gone?
Really well. I'm so excited. I mean, I've had so many people writing to me, and there's so much going on, and people are really embracing it and understanding the culture and wanted to cook from it, which is for me the most important part of it, that people takes it into their kitchen and actually cook things from it and experience the flavors.
But here's the incredible thing, though. So, you know, random page, Roasted chicken with rhubarb and tarragon. Czech would like that. Cod, the traditional way. I'm going to have that. Meatballs with celeriac. Any meatballs, please. Childhood curry. And it just goes on. I think the amazing thing about this, every single page, because I think a lot of contemporary cookbooks as well, you'd say, yeah, you know, on, at a really good book, you'd want 70% of what's there. I want all of it.
Or that you run your finger down the ingredients list and you realize you probably would take like 2 weeks just to find all the ingredients.
No.
And that's a good thing that many of these seem very honest recipes.
Yes. Yeah, and I think they are for people who live in this part of the world. You know, it's very seasonal, you know, celeriac and kale and, you know, pork. That's what we're going to eat right now. And you can buy that in the UK and in the northern part of Europe. So I think it is for people, you know, who live around here.
Now, yeah. We dragged you in here on the 25th. What's your key favourite food at Christmas?
Caramel potatoes and a duck leg.
Oh, that sounds good.
Coming around to yours right after this. Trina Hanneman, very good to see you in Studio One here. Gladio. Merry Christmas. Very good to see you. The book is Scandinavian Comfort Food, and it is just an absolute delight. You're listening to a very special Christmas edition of the Monocle Weekly. Stay with us.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
Now, Monocle listeners, you might very well be familiar with the voice of Kathleen Burke. She is Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College here in London and regularly appears on our current events and news shows.
But Kathleen is also an authority on wine. She's published books on the topic, such as Is This Bottle Corked? And she was raised by a California grape farmer, no less. She's here today to tell us what tipples go with a turkey, or the correct vino for your veggies. Kathleen, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Pleasure to be here.
It's great to see you. And you've got a proper kind of... Well,
how big is that lineup? I can't even see from here.
Seven, I fear.
Okay. You've raided your cellar for us.
Well, I became a bit incontinent. I mean, I was asked to bring in a bottle or two, and I went out and I thought, I'd like to show them this. So I'm sorry about that. You may have to... But you don't have to drink them all.
And you've gone from red to whites?
I did. I started out with what everyone seems to think is great for Christmas. I have quite an old white Burgundy here, a Corton Charlemagne 2000 Grand Cru.
And why do people think that's a good Christmas tipple?
Well, they think it's a good tipple altogether because white Burgundy is, if it's nice, it's a great wine. But it's, this one is 16 years old. You can have it either with your turkey or your chicken. And if you're a vegetarian, it's utterly wonderful. Or things like, pumpkin soup and so forth. You could also have it with roasted cod if you're a pescatorian, as it were. But fundamentally, this is lovely with white meats and anything with sauces, white sauces that aren't too heavy. If it's too heavy, you need something to cut through it. But this has a shot of acid. But can I pour you a tablespoon each, just to see what you think?
That would be great. I've got a couple of glasses here. Should I do the pouring for you, maybe?
That would be kind, yeah.
Let me...
I mean, the thing is, white Burgundy is very different. If you like something really steely, you're going to go to the very top of the Burgundy area, and that's Chablis. Corton Charlemagne isn't as buttery as Meursault, but it has a cutting edge as well as the background, the fullness at the bottom and the oak.
This is quite rounded, I think, would be... Yeah, almost as sort of round as the turkey on the table, maybe later today. It's lovely.
It's rich.
Yeah, it's rich.
It's very, and it is oddly quite Christmas.
Well, it's quite any time. If you'd like to, I won't tell you how much it cost. That's not fair. but it's a great wine. It's a bit dicey because when I opened up with my Coravin 2 last night and one got poured down the sink because white Burgundy and around that period, I've poured more 1970, 97, 98 Burgundy down the sink that would make you cry. So it's a problem. I mean, when the wines are great, they're great, but they can be fragile, shall we say.
No, we said you wrote a book called Is This Bottle Cork?
Yes.
And I see that there are no screw caps here at all in your lineup. Do you eschew the screw cap? Are you opposed to... I was going to say opposed to the screw. But anyway...
I wouldn't even think about that one.
It's a Christmas family show, Andrew.
Well, no. I mean, the point is, if you get any New Zealand wine to screw cap now, you have no choice. So if you want to go down the Antipodes, you have to have screw caps. I don't care in the sense that... For white wines, it's probably very good. It keeps them fresh. Unfortunately, if they're already bad, it keeps them bad. I'm holding judgment on great reds. When Chateau Latour, then perhaps I will trot along behind, not buying it, but seeing it. Can I show
Let's
you
do something. Yeah, what do we got next?
This is an Alsace Pinot Gris, a.k.a. Pinot Grigio in Italy, in its much lesser form. I think this is an alternative, alternative in certain ways to your white Burgundy. It's a wine that's not so well known to non-keen drinkers, as it were. Comes in a whole range from very steely to almost, that's a slight off dry one.
Right.
Now, that also would be wonderful with all sorts of things. It's wonderful with certain fish, for example. Again, it has enough acid to cut through your heavy bean soup, you know, or light root soups, that sort of thing.
And but, very fragrant. It's, you can smell it 6 inches away from your nose, that bouquet. It's really rich.
Well, the Domaine Weinbach is one of the greats. Great Alsace producers. A mother and two daughters. Unfortunately, the great winemaking daughter died a year ago and the mother died a few months later. So, I'm buying up all the older Weinbach to see what happens. But when we get to cheese, I want to say something desperately important about Pinot Gris. Okay? But what did you think?
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah.
But anyone who knows a Pinot Grigio, obviously, same the relatives, but very doesn't have the let's say the sharpness or the that sort of that clarity that a Pinot Grigio has. This is, again, it's I think this is all very very smooth and as Andrew, as you said, incredibly fragrant as well.
Pinot Grigio is mostly harmless. if you want a great use of the Pinot Gris grape, you go to Germany, of course, Grauburgunder.
Yes, I love a good Grauburgunder.
Okay, we move along.
Now, I'm a Riesling woman. I brought in two Rieslings here, both by one of the absolute great producers of the Mosel, J.J. Prume. And 2007 is a great year. I brought two. I brought their sweetness and quality. You go up the mark, and a Cabernet is drier than a Spätlese, which means late. In other words, the grapes have been left on the vine to get a bit more sugar, okay? Well, the great Hugh Johnson sometime, somewhere, wrote that crab and Riesling is part of the creator's plan. I want you to try this.
Maybe. Are you ready?
Oh, I'll give you start.
Here's a glass. Now, tell me, we said that you grew up, your dad was a grape grower and was making bottles in California?
No. We had...
Andrew, do your research.
Well, I knew that Kathleen would correct me.
That's
right.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm here for, to correct you, Andrew, time and time again. Here, this is the Spätlese is a slightly sweeter one, which has other uses. Yes, we six kids, family farm.
Well, this is an
acres.
Afternoon nap. That's what I call this. This is like very nice. This is like
settle back, listeners.
Yeah. Well, just to say that we grew the grapes and took them either to be packed.
Andrew, pass me that.
Or to this
one.
A local winery.
Which one are you starting with? Sorry,
That's one you just had.
I didn't have that. No, I cleaned my glass.
I've got to put it here.
I was doing a bit of a.
This is what happens when you hang out in a
bar. I was doing a bit of a Perrier swirl.
but even the Cabernet is much. Yeah, there's a little bit more sugar.
This is just also. Aside from that, it is an after nap in Germany. There's just, it's so, this could only be a German wine.
Probably. And chilled before lunch, before dinner, or by itself, no doubt. But crab is a slightly sweet fish, isn't it? You can sort of see how that might go with it, I think.
So tell me, which is the sweeter one we were going to try?
The Spätlese is the sweeter one.
So, and then just tell me, so you sent the grapes off, but from an early age, were you drinking wine at home? Is this where your appreciation came from?
Well, I knew it was around, shall we say. Went off to Berkeley decks ago, and my boyfriend had a 750cc motorcycle. And we'd go around Napa, and I'd ride pinion, and he'd drive, and I'd taste. Then when I got to Oxford, I discovered European wines.
You never fell off the back?
No, and he never fell off the front. That's because I did the drinking. No. I'm quite a good sense of balance. I hold my wines quite well.
Mm. Now, we were saying, what's interesting is, you know, you're somebody who's come on the radio throughout the year charting what's happening in US politics and all the events around the world. Are there events when you have like a tragic moment, maybe like Mr. Trump being elected, you think, I know what I'm going to reach for in the cellar today. I know what will calm my nerves. Are there political bottles of wine in your cellar?
Political bottles.
Or comfort, let's just call it. Yeah.
We're back to port.
Right.
I'm a keen port woman. I brought along a bottle of 20-year-old tawny port for you to try.
Well, we'll be calling you back, Andrew, for the March issue, because I think there's going to be a lot of, well, beyond Porto, yes, definitely. And that will be, we should probably save a bit of that. But we can always end the segment with a bit of port, though.
Yeah, so I think maybe we only
you're
have time
to.
For one more. So should we dive to the port?
No, you're going to
quickly.
Well, it depends. You're going to get port
to
even if
in.
I go. This is a 2000 claret, mm-hmm, Grand Cru. I might leave these bottles with you if you promise to try them. Whereas this is one of the greatest Californian wines.
So all going straight up to my office after this. Thank you very much.
And this for fruitiness. So vegetarians who have lots of, lots of vegetable stews and that sort of thing, they need a bit more fruit. And a Zinfandel is a really good one. And this Californian Ridge Geyserville Zinfandel is one of the greats. So the claret, no one's born liking old claret. You have to sort of grow to it. And a lot of people still don't because it's not as fruity when it ages. Zinfandel will keep its fruit.
Mm.
Beautiful.
Very nice.
Okay, finally,
mm-hmm,
I brought this cheese for you to try.
Thank you.
Is this another one or is this same?
The same. It's Conte, which is probably almost the greatest cheese, I mean, for wines. And I brought some tawny port. Tawny port is great not only for cheese, it's also great for Christmas pudding.
Mm-hmm. This one for you.
It's great for chocolate.
It's getting very complicated in this studio, I must say.
Yes.
You're going to have to go back and listen to this and take notes. You realize that.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Thank you. And let me... Oh, this is good. Well, what an amazing color.
And what did you make down there? You made like a rosé. What is that down there?
that's the vintage.
I was going to say. Anyway.
The one thing I did want to say about Pinot Gris before you shove me out of the studio is that is probably the single best white wine that covers a range of foods. It's the single best white wine for all sorts of cheeses because great red wines with cheese is a crime. Because think, cheese is salty.
Mm-hmm.
Salty makes those tannins in red wines bitter.
Mm-hmm.
And any great wine, it would be appalling if you used it with a great wine. If you're going to have your cheese, have a white wine.
Before we wrap, just tell us, for people who are planning, you know, like you, to build up a bit of a stock in the cellar, what's one or two wines that you might consider buying, investing in, making sure that you have in your cellar for 2017?
Well, you mean ones that you'd buy now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, for fruitiness, Ravenswood Zinfandel, which isn't very expensive, about 11 to 12 pounds, is really one of the great names in California and affordable. That's the entry level. White, well, I'm a Riesling woman. Riesling will last 10, 20, 30 years. Burgundy is difficult. A lot of people go for, white Rhone wines. Rhone wines we haven't talked about, but they are some of the great wines. And I would look for some southern French white wines would be really good. Those are all a bit unusual. It will set you out from your friends, and you still enjoy it tremendously.
Well, Kathleen, I hope you have a very nice, relaxed week ahead, finishing off a few of these bottles. And
even relaxed afternoon.
Yeah, and I hope you've got plenty to toast yourself through New Year as well. But Kathleen Burke, thank you very much for joining us on
Merry
the Monocle
Christmas.
Weekly.
Monocle has bureau around the world in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo, once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. Doesn't matter how long I'm here, there's always something new. It's a very, it's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. There's more discover all the time, and also there's so much that's new in Tokyo. Most months, actually most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested, you know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on. So there's always something to keep us interested.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are still with the Christmas edition of the Monocle Weekly with me, Tyler Brûlé, and Andrew Tuck. Andrew, how are you feeling after a little bit of Kringle, lots of wine?
We had it slightly in the wrong order, I think, because we went from like cake to cheese. Yeah, but I was very happy.
Yeah, well, I'm glad Midori House is almost empty today, which is good, which means hopefully there aren't too many people snarfing back that Kringle, because I'm hoping it's there. No, the port was very nice as well.
Yeah, I like it.
We didn't really talk about the port. The port, I thought, is very closely related to Canadian maple syrup.
There was some amazing wines there, but there was a real kind of sense that one glass of each of those and you'd be done for the day.
Absolutely.
You'd be in bed by six tonight.
I said you probably will want to be kicking back when we leave this studio. Maybe kicking back to a little bit of music as well. I think a nice bottle of something. And how lovely it would be if someone was tickling the ivories beside you. Well, I just said the ivories. I'm not tickling anything else, Andrew.
I've got some news for you.
What?
Well, we're very lucky to be joined by jazz pianist Bill Lawrence. Bill is a founding...
Oh, that's what that man is doing in the corner.
Yes.
I was wondering.
Now, Bill, he's a founding member of the US-based jazz outfit Snarky Puppy, and his solo albums, which include 2014's Flint, which went straight to number one in the iTunes jazz charts, and this year's After Sun, have pushed the genre into new forms. His latest is Live at Union Chapel, and we'll have a quick chat with Bill in a moment. But first, here he is. Thank you. Wow.
It's Christmas Day here on Monocle 24. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly with me, Tyler Berlay, Andrew Tuck, and of course, beautifully accompanied by Bill Lawrence. That was absolutely lovely. Welcome around the table.
Thank you.
Sorry, Andrew, knocked back all the wine while you were there. That was absolute delight.
Yeah, amazing. Just tell us a little bit about Snarky Puppy, which is a very good name. And I'm struck by reading the names of your other band members, whereas you're called Bill Lawrence. You've got Sput Seawright, Weedy Braemar, and you're Bill Lawrence. Where did your jazz name go?
I guess it's because I don't come from, a gospel tradition in the south of the United States. I guess I'm sort of the token English member of Snarky Puppy.
And how did those original kind of connections get made that you're playing with people from New Orleans, you're playing people from the States? Was it through gigging? Was it through being on the road? How did you make a band up across those long distances?
Sure. I mean, the band originally originated out at the University of North Texas in Dallas, and so the band kind of started, you know, like at a jazz college, effectively. And then kind of once a lot of the band members left the college, they started working as part of the Dallas scene there and started
playing. So is Dallas quite a big jazz city?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of really kind of well-known names, their bands are based out of there. Erykah Badu, Snoop Dogg, you know, this kind of urban scene is really sort of vibrant, particularly in that part of the world. And you know, the sort of black gospel scene, the church scene is massive there as well. And I remember going to I was kind of sitting in on as part of a congregation. I remember me and Mike League, the other founder of Snarky Puppy, we were the only white guys in the congregation. And, you know, we were like 18, 19 years old, and it was kind of a really sort of eye-opening experience, just seeing music be kind of used in that context where faith plays such a large role. And that's where we met Robert Sput Seawright, who was playing in that church. And so we kind of inherited all these sort of gospel influences in the sound of the band, and that kind of gave it this kind of, I guess, slightly more cool kind of foundation from the rhythm point of view. Like Robert Sput Seawright toured with Snoop Dogg for 6 years, and Sean Martin also played with Snoop and Erykah Badu, and there's that whole kind of thing influencing the sound of Snarky.
It's quite a collection of talents. And just tell us about the latest live at Union Chapel. What is this a melange of?
So that's, I guess, now that Snarky's doing his own thing, everyone in the band is starting to kind of branch away and forge their own solo careers. So I released my first album in 2014. And this is my fourth live, it's my fourth record, my first live album of a concert of my own music that was recorded at London's Union Chapel. And it was part of a European tour we did last year. And it was really amazing. It was kind of towards the end of the tour, and we had a lot of momentum at that point. And it was a sellout show, and it was kind of, you know, my entire family and friends were all there. And it was with me and Michael League on bass from Snarky, Robert Sput Seawright on drums, this amazing percussionist, a really young, amazing talent called Felix Higginbottom on percussion. And then we featured this string trio called the West Side Trio from the Netherlands Metropole Orchestra. And then Katie Christie on French horn. So it was quite a sort of large sort of symphonic ensemble and sound that we were kind of going for. But we caught it on DVD, and it's I think, you know, it seems to have been received well, and you know, it was definitely the highlight of the tour.
And tell me, what's the career of a contemporary jazz man? Because when I look at your CV, you've done amazing work with the likes of Ballet Rombert, with Matthew Bourne. So you've done a lot of work in the dance world. You do a lot of work with other musicians, with other singers, bringing their work to life as well. Is there a kind of a two parts to your life in a way, that there is this kind of on the road, the musician, and then there's the reality of, you know, sitting down, commissioning, being commissioned and doing work for other people?
Sure, definitely. I think, you know, now more than ever, it's about trying to spin as many plates as you can, and especially with the changing industry of, you know, the fact that we can't sell records in the way that we used that we were able to in the past, you know, we have to kind of forge other ways to make a living. And so I've been really fortunate to, you know, years ago, I've started playing for dance classes, and a lot of the music that I've put into my own albums has kind of been conceived through working with dance, and having, you know, movement to kind of accompany my music has been a real inspiration. So yeah, I've really enjoyed working with dance, but I like to write when I'm traveling, so I find that when my context is changing all the time, that's kind of when I'm most inspired, and I'm just, you know, I'm often writing in the back of the bus, the back of the tour bus, with a little one octave MIDI keyboard, and I've just got my laptop and my headphones, and with the scenes changing all the time and the landscapes, I use that as my inspiration, and or even, you know, the rhythm of the train that I'm on, I kind of use as my BPM, and then I'll kind of write to that, you know. So I find being on the move is a good place to be inspired, you know.
Well, Bill, I think Andrew set himself up, or maybe you, because Andrew likes a bit of dance, and I'm thinking, you know. Now that you're sort of half flying, I thought maybe we could have a little interpretive number at the other end of the studio.
The next number.
Well, Bill Lawrence, we'll hopefully be hearing a little bit more from you a bit later in the program. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly Christmas edition here from Studio One at Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé, and Andrew Tuck. Stay with us.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Still listening to the Monocle Weekly Christmas special with me, Tyler Brûlé.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
God, there you are. Coming up in the next hour, we'll hear from actor Jason Isaacs about his latest Netflix film, The OA.
We'll also review the year in architecture and urbanism with Peter Murray.
And we'll be learning the best spots to escape to on New Year with Ava Kaldic, co-founder of Be Home.
Plus Monocle's very own Secret Santa, Robert Bound, will be popping down the chimney too. That's in the next hour here on the Monocle Weekly Christmas special.
Now, many of you will be relaxing at home with loved ones today, and a bit of Christmas TV is part of the holiday season. One of the more unusual series you may have caught over the past week or so is Netflix's new supernatural drama, The OA.
The series takes a bold look at what it means to be alive, and also questions whether there might be angels walking among us. But that's where the seasonal references stop. Created by uncompromising duo Britt Marling and Zal Batemglitch, it's a challenging watch, and not for the faint-hearted.
Challenging mouthful of names as well. A little earlier, our producer Tom Hall sat down with one of the show's stars, British actor Jason Isaacs, to learn more about The OA. Jason began by explaining why he doesn't want to give too many plot lines away.
More than anything I've ever done, which is quite a lot of things over 30 years, is that to talk about it ruins it. It's got the most phenomenal story, in the sense that it both sideswipes you as it unfolds and also continues to make you wonder whether you should have trusted anything you thought in the first place. If people are what you think they are, and when you judge people, be careful lest you be judged, because I'm not sure that anything that happens is exactly as it really happened. So I can tell you how it starts, which isn't too much of a spoiler, which is that a young woman turns up who'd been missing for years. She was blind when she went missing. She's not anymore. And from that point on, almost nothing normal happens. It goes into some of the boldest creative areas and makes some of the riskiest choices I've ever seen things do on a screen. My only advice, I mean, I don't want to tell people what the story is. Maybe we'll get into it a bit. I feel like it's spoiling it, is that make sure you've got nothing to do the next day, because you'll do what many, many people have been doing, which is stay up all night and not be able to stop yourself watching all eight of them.
It's interesting, that ambiguous ground that a lot of the plot seems to be centering on. I mean, I'm only a few episodes in, and again, we can't give people spoilers, but it seems quite an effective tool.
There's a lot of storytelling. There are layers of storytelling in this. And it's not giving too much away to say that you can't always believe what stories you're being told or the storytellers themselves. But if you concentrate hard enough and your mind is open enough, you might have some sense of where it's going. And if you do, then you're a lot smarter than I was.
And tell us about what attracted you to a script like this, to a project like this, because it's that thing where we can't give away an ending. We don't know the ending. But, I mean, I'm getting the impression that before you sign on that dotted line, you're given a hint of where you're going.
No, I read them all. Yeah. I mean, when you do American network television, for instance, which, you know, we don't have anything but ABC, CBS, NBC, all this stuff, they'll write the first episode of something and they'll make lots of first episodes called pilots. And if they like them, they'll commission a series and you just jump in and they're hoping not. It's not a question of whether they know where it's going to end. They're praying it never will end. And they're just going to keep whatever story is going as long as possible. This is different. Britt and Zal, the lead actress and the director, wrote this thing start to finish and went around with their 8 episodes. And there was a huge bidding war because everybody wanted to put it on. And Netflix won. And when I was offered the job, something catastrophic had just happened. They needed an actor to step in at half a day's notice and fly to America, get off the plane and shoot a giant scene. So I said, can I read it all? They didn't send me all of it. In fact, I read half of it. I phoned up and said, send the rest. I said, will you do it? And I went, send me the rest. There was a kind of Mexican standoff because I was just frothing at the mouth to read the end of it. They sent me the other episodes. And by the time my kids came down for breakfast, I was packed and ready to leave.
Well, if that's not an endorsement, I don't know what is. But there's sometimes, I think people have a perception of the way these series are made. I don't know whether it's really used as a verb, but the Lost effect.
I'm glad you went there.
Yeah,
no, because
people are so keen to keep something good going that sometimes things can just go a little bit nuts in a bad way.
Not just sometimes, many, many times. So Lost fucked it up for a lot of people for many years because they managed to pull off keeping an audience and then tying it all together in a way at the end that made it look, if you weren't concentrating too hard, like they always had a plan. They really didn't have a plan. They were winging it. And so many new series started up by promising that there's this giant tapestry they were going to unfold for you. And if you're at all inside the business, you can see that they replaced the writers and the showrunners so many times that clearly no one ever had a big picture in mind. And so it's such a relief to do something when there really is a beginning, middle, and end of stories. Zal and Britt have got such a full universe mapped out of this thing. I can't spoil it by telling you how much of it, but nothing is left to chance in this, and they certainly weren't winging it, which I've done many times. Some of the things in this, when you're watching it, that might seem insignificant because they had the whole picture and they've had it in their heads for years, they all come back into play. You know, at some point, everything will have been relevant somewhere, which is just, it's just enormously satisfying as a viewer.
We're talking about a new Netflix production over the Christmas season. People are going to be doing what, in a quite scarily rapid amount of time, has become almost just a tradition or a way of living. They are going to be bedding down on their sofas. They're going to be ploughing through series and box sets. You've worked in TV, but you've also worked in some huge films. Mm. And there always used to be that slight snobbiness about maybe the film world looking down a little bit to the TV world.
Yeah. Not for years and years now.
Are you also feeling this kind of rebirth of TV as a really exciting medium to make really fantastically well thought out brand projects?
First of all, I think not in any way to be insulting the monocle, which is clearly way ahead of the curve. But in that comment, you're years behind the curve because television's been television's been the place to go to for sophisticated, subtle dramas that don't answer all the questions. Films have been aimed at teenagers for years now. And if you think about it, most adults don't go out that much, and young people go out more, particularly once you have kids or you have a job, you don't go out. And television's been the place to tell more long-form stories with much more complex and richer characters for quite a while on pay cable. So for a long time, if you lived in America, where I did, HBO and Showtime made those shows, and we got them here on British television. And we, of course, made some of our own shows that were provocative like that.
Yeah.
But American telly, the meat and potatoes on network television was men running around with guns and stuff. But that spread over the last many years, you know, the Walking Dead and Breaking Bad, those were not on the pay cable. They weren't on the expensive, what they call premium cable. They were on free-to-air networks. And those kinds of shows really broke the mold because they were trying to compete with the big networks. They knew there was no point doing a hospital drama or a lawyer drama or a cop drama. So they've been really doing interesting work for a long time.
Yeah.
And now along come Netflix and Amazon and Hulu to an extent and YouTube Red, they hope, and streaming services that are completely free from any of the traditional models. And they, in order to be noticed and make stuff that is memorable and last, they're taking really big creative swings. And because of that, they're attracting the creators, showrunners, who will take less money to do something and be given the space to tell the stories the way they want to tell them. So it's a magical time for audiences. On the other hand, me being a gloom and doom merchant, it's also true that there aren't enough eyeballs in the English-speaking world to sustain how much drama is being made at the moment.
That's interesting.
Everybody's making it. All these networks, and I mean, if you've got a big package of cable stuff in Britain or in America, you get hundreds of channels. Well, so many of them now are commissioning original drama and paying proper money for it, you know, making big budget things. And then you've got all the streaming services. At some point in a few years' time, there'll only be a few left standing because, you know, there's just, you can't watch all of it, or
right,
you can't
yeah.
even watch most of it. And people are doing other things in their life as well. They're going online, they're doing video games and stuff. So it's both a magical time and it feels like a giant bubble too that surely has to burst.
Do you feel it's almost the same way that many things are in their infancy, where that, you know, like the dot-com boom in the late 90s, where there was this huge explosion of creativity and then suddenly people, as you say, this is unsustainable and perhaps it will shrink a bit, but the quality will stay high.
Who knows?
The smaller it gets, obviously, I think the quality will go up probably.
Who knows what wins out? I mean, I think one of the things the last year has shown us in every sphere, particularly politics, is anyone who tells you what's about to happen is an ass. And so all you can do is be in the moment. We're making some great telly. The series I'm in, I think, is fantastic. I wouldn't have abandoned my wife and kids to bugger off to New York if I didn't think it was worth doing. And you just try and take each day as it comes. In my job, I try and do and find interesting things to do and let go of the results, because I've been in some fantastic things that flopped and some crappy things that everybody saw. And,
yeah.
You know, so you just try and make the best stuff you can.
Yeah. And over Christmas, people will be perhaps familiar, not just because of your extended back catalogue, but there is one film or set of films that you've been in that are very Christmassy, the Harry Potter films.
That's a very tenuous link. How are they Christmassy? What are you talking about? You're just trying to squeeze Harry Potter into conversation.
They are magical.
Anywhere you can.
They are magical.
They are magical. I like
you cannot
it.
Deny
nice
they are magical.
No.
Yeah. And Christmas is a magical time of year. Are you?
I thought you were going to burst into song there for a minute.
Careful, it's not beyond me. But do you kind of take equal joy in maybe those slightly more, I don't want to say camp roles, but kind of more larger than life roles?
I mean,
you've played everyone from,
if I could get off my this desk, I would flounce out the room immediately.
You've played everyone from the from the demure hunter in the OA to Captain Hook. I mean, and do you enjoy playing the role?
I've done it just this year. I went to New York and Cuba to shoot the OA. And then I did Death of Stalin, Amanda Iannucci's fantastic film, in which there are many, many much larger-than-life characters. I certainly hit the ground running. Steve Buscemi and Jeffrey Tambor and Paul Whitehouse and Michael Palin. Everybody's doing very big acting in it.
Paul Whitehouse is a hugely underrated actor.
He's fantastic.
Yeah,
he really surprised me. Paddy Considine, Andrew Rice. This amazing cast, but everybody's doing proper big acting, camp as you might call it. And then I did a very realistic film called Hotel Mumbai, which is about the siege in the Taj Hotel in 2008 in India. And then I just did a little young adult thriller / horror film and stuff. And one of the things, when it's working well for me, that I love about my job is the variety. I just try and tell a story in the style of the storyteller who's telling it. And I don't like any one thing more than another. What I would hate, I think, is to be asked to do the same thing again and again.
Yeah.
That would feel like purgatory to me.
Would you ever be interested in a role in Panto?
Do you know what? I was offered years ago, I did a thing called Civvies, in which I played this very tough soldier. And I was offered Uncle Ebenezer in, I think, Watford Palace Panto. And I got snotty about it. I was 30 and I thought, pfft. And I regret it enormously, because it's a very valid form of entertainment. It's instant, fabulous feedback from the audience. You know, you only have to do it for a couple of months. It's not like signing up for 6 months. I used to be a children's entertainer at birthday parties and stuff. And it's fabulously good fun. It's a real skill. The people who do it well are brilliant. And I wouldn't mind taking up the challenge, seeing if I could pull it off, but I'm not sure that I'll ever be asked back again.
I was listening to an interview with Paul O'Grady, actually, the other day, and he's doing Panto, which maybe wouldn't surprise.
Yeah, no, but he would be genius.
Exactly.
The people who are great at it, it's great.
But one observation he made that I found it was quite funny, but actually quite surprising. He was like, oh, well, sometimes, you know, US stars will come over and cameo in the panto world, and they really have no concept of the fact that the booing, it's almost like an applause. You know? They're like, why don't they like me? And it's, I couldn't believe that something so obvious of the panto world wouldn't translate like that.
If you say the word pantomime to American, they think you mean mime. They think you mean whiteface. A couple of times I've referenced panto as what I think would be a nice easy gag, and they look really confused. But it is such a peculiarly English or British form of entertainment, and I love it. I take my kids to panto whenever I could. I went when I was a kid. That was the only theatre I ever saw. I wasn't brought up in a particularly cultured household. If I had thought about it when I was young, the only actors I'd ever seen were in panto.
Well, Jason Isaacs, he's not in panto yet.
Not yet. Well, I've got some very camp films coming out soon.
Indeed, but he's in the OA, and everyone should go and check it out. And thanks so much for talking to us on Monocle 24.
I hope everybody enjoys it.
That was Jason Isaacs there talking to Monocle's Tom Hall. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly Christmas special on Monocle 24.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
And that was a very zippy sting. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Very Merry Christmas. I'm Tyler Brûlé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
Bill Lawrence is in the corner with another song. Take it away, sir. Thank you.
Wow.
Beautiful. That was Bill Lawrence with Madeline. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're going away for a short break, aren't we, Andrew?
Yes.
Back in a moment.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio. Every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
Well, we're joined now by Peter Murray, chairman of the New London Architecture Centre. He's going to be taking us on a tour of some of his favourite urbanism and architectural projects of 2016.
And he's even managed to help us stay loosely on theme by giving his picks of some Christmassy references. Welcome, Peter. Tell us a little bit more.
Good to see you.
Yes. Very good to see you.
Well, I thought I'd think about some presents. And last year, actually, for Christmas, it was very good that the Royal Institute of British Architects gave the Royal Gold Medal to Zaha Hadid. It was about time, and as you probably know, she sadly died later in the year. But that was the it was a righting of a 180-year wrong, they said, because the RABA had never given a medal to a woman before, at least a woman on her own. Charles and Ray Eames had won it together, but Zaha was the first person to actually win that as a woman. And actually, about the same time, the American Institute of Architects gave their gold medal to Paul Revere Williams, who was actually the first African-American to receive their award.
So do you feel that 2016 has marked a moment when, actually after a very long time, the industry has been a little bit broken open and it's made to be seen that anybody could potentially be an architect? It doesn't matter what your background is, your heritage is, your gender is. It should be easier to get through to the kind of the top of the pile these days.
One would hope so, because you also saw David Adjaye, of course, with his Smithsonian African-American museum opening in September. But at the same time, in Britain, you have increasing cost of architecture education, which is actually making it more and more difficult for people from ethnic backgrounds to get into the profession. So I'm afraid when you actually look at the cross-section of students coming into architecture, it's not as varied as you would really like.
Now, we've discussed presents and prize-giving. Illumination, lighting, obviously some very lovely things around at this time of year, some rather gaudy things. But if we look in an architectural sphere, what's been outstanding for you?
Well, I think the big thing is the announcement of a competition to light up the bridges on the Thames, which was announced last week at the Tate Gallery. And the winner was Leo Villarreal from New York and Lifshutz Davidson Architects from London. And they have a plan to light up bridges all the way down the river. And I was in Shanghai the other day and looking at the lighting they've got. Rather garish for London, but it is amazing what you can do with LEDs these days. I mean, 100-storey buildings just lit up with great artworks along their facade. So that was pretty spectacular. But I think that we talk in London about some of the tall buildings, whether they're actually going to be lit at all, whether it means that overseas investors are going to buy them and not occupy them. And I think the story that I find quite interesting was one of the Paddington Pole, which was a scheme by Renzo Piano that was so unpopular with the locals that it was withdrawn even before it went in for planning permission.
And tell me, this year here in London especially has been about two buildings, the opening of the Design Museum and the Switch House at the Tate. Both have kind of split opinion a little bit about their success at what they do and their value. What was your take on them both?
I think that the Commonwealth Institute, as it was, which has now been converted into the Design Museum, wonderful roof shape, Very difficult building to deal with inside, though, but I think John Paulson has done a very good job of creating a box that will provide an excellent background for the design there. Great place for parties, actually, if the opening party is
I didn't bump into you, but Herzog de Meuron's Switch House?
I find that a little bit more difficult. I think their choice of bricks is absolutely brilliant. I find the inside curious to find my way around, but once you get up to the top, you have these spectacular views across London. But as a shape, it's fine. As a place to use, not quite so good.
Yeah, I had the same impression that there wasn't actually that much space added in a sense, and it felt that part of it was just to build a building to have a viewing terrace, which seemed to be a bit odd in the end.
Yes, and looking into people's flats in a Richard Rogers development next door, which people don't seem to like.
Mm. I want to just go, Andrew, have you been to the Design Museum?
Yes. Yet?
And what was your thought and comment? Because it seems to be universally damned in this building so far.
Not absolute damnation. I found it... It's interesting that they've kept the volume for kind of arrivals. Mm. Event architecture is quite important. And the exhibition spaces feel to be a little bit tucked away. And then my only tiny negative was that there are these two amazing trusses that run across the roof. And one of them is slightly hidden behind a wall of rather light, kind of not very important timber. So that was the only thing. I felt that some of the engineering of the building, I would have liked to have seen even more rawly at
but also
the front.
And the approach as well. I think the position from the high street, I mean, looking in is just no sense. I mean, there was just a lot of like Tesco bags blowing around.
I would agree. I think that's a great shame. And actually what they should have done is to replan that whole area, including the entrance to the park, and create a proper public space there to take people into it. And actually, it's quite difficult to see. The developers of the surrounding residential scheme are quite fussy about putting signage on the side of their building, which will make it even more difficult for people coming through to see actually where the museum is at all, which is not a good thing.
Should we jump across the Atlantic, perhaps, in search of a midwinter glow. I believe something has caught your attention from Mr. Nouvel.
Yes, well, he has built a new set of apartments in Miami Beach, which is 14 feet off the ground. And this is going there for winter sun, but also when you go to Miami Beach now, you have to watch out for global warming, and climate change is having an impact on sea levels there. And actually, there are a lot of work going on raising street levels at the moment. And Jean Nouvel has looked ahead a bit to when there's even more water flooding over the place. And that shows, I think, the sort of change which is taking place when you have the governor of Florida actually says that they cannot use the words climate change in any public document in Miami, yet you go to Miami Beach and you can actually see it happening.
Well, and it's also amazing, I think, what's going to happen under Trump, because most of these US cities, they have administrations which are actually acutely aware of what's going on, and whether you're in California, even Florida, and certainly in the likes of New York, they're not going to follow the line coming out of Washington, D.C., and their architecture and their belief in LEED buildings, I think, is going to be even more robust, don't you?
I do. And when I was in Miami, actually looking at some of the work that was being done on raising street levels, there was also Zaha Hadid's 1000 Biscayne Avenue Museum. It was just coming out of the ground. It was a big poster on the side saying her spirit lives on, which I thought was very touching when I went past it.
And just going back to that development, how much of that do you think is really being used by, within the marketing suites as an interesting selling point to make things look a little bit obviously inferior down the beach, you know, versus it really being seen as this is something which is purely practical and necessary?
I think he's pushing it a bit to go to 14 feet. You don't need that till probably about end of the 22nd century. But I think it is making a point about something which is very real there. And as I say, work is being done by the local Department of Transportation to raise roads. And actually, that is putting in danger some of the 30s buildings in South Beach, because it's very difficult to know what to do when they're actually way below street level and you get sea levels rising up above the foundations.
Well, Peter Murray, chairman of the new London Architecture Centre, very good to see you, and have a happy holiday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Stay with us. Andrew, we're nearly at the end of the Monocle Weekly Christmas special, but many of our listeners might be starting to think about where to head for New Year. If a design-focused, beautiful home is a requirement, is it?
Always.
Okay, good. Then you might already be familiar with Be Home.
Well, the design-focused home exchange service was founded by the graphic designers Ava Kalduch and also by Auguste Just 4 years ago. And Ava joins us on the line now from Barcelona to give us a few tips on locations. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Just quickly tell us what Be Home does. Is it kind of a, well, I don't want to say the word really, but is it an Airbnb for people who actually have got some taste?
Oh, hi. Not really. Many people say it's an Airbnb for creatives, but there is no money exchange among members. So there is nothing related to renting.
So you literally switch houses with somebody else who has good taste or taste that you like.
Right. And you just leave your home to your exchange partners, and there is no money exchange of any kind. So very different to Airbnb or any renting.
And give
site.
Us an example of the kinds of properties we might find on your site.
Wow, all kind of properties, from really small ones, like a tiny Dan Musso in Pantelleria in an island, to really palazzos. There are several palazzos. You know, you all range from people sometimes think, oh, this is for really, you know, luxurious homes. Not at all. We keep saying that taste has nothing to do with luxury.
I'm always interested on the business side of things because obviously there are so many startups, there are so many things happening in a sort of swapping, sharing economy. I'm interested, how do you monetize this business?
Yeah, there is a membership fee that you pay 95 euros right now, very cheap, so many people can join. And also we have some sponsors in our newsletters. This is our way of making money right now.
What's on the books currently? So you know, if someone could, you know, sign up right away, get going, is there scope? And I like the sound of the Demuso in Pantelleria, having been there a few times. That sounds good. What else is on offer?
Oh, there is a last minute list where you can just look and see the dates available of people. But it's an exchange that there are no point system. You join the community, you look at the homes you like, and you contact directly, and you agree with the other partners. You know, it's very easy.
Ava Kalduch from BM, very, very good to speak to you. Have a very Merry Christmas, a great holiday. Hopefully we'll speak soon.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You are listening to almost the end of the Monocle Weekly. Andrew, he's making a list. I don't think he's checked it twice. He's both nodding nice. Who are we talking about?
Mr. Robert Bound.
Oh.
It's like the good old days, isn't it?
This is classic, isn't it? This is classic
it is
weekly.
We're all grown up now, aren't we? Remember back in the days. In the days in Fitzrovia, in that funny little studio.
Yeah, and it took us like several hours to make 1 hour of radio.
Well, that was because everyone had at least one bottle of wine. And now this is a special Christmas broadcast.
And also, we never went back to the office after that did that as well. Yeah. So.
Get the Addison Lee straight to the Yorkshire Grey. I think that's how it used to work. It's become a holy trinity. How Christmassy.
Very, very nice to see you.
I don't know
you.
About how holy it is.
how was your Christmas Eve?
It's wonderful. Yeah. It's been good. It's been
down Sussex way, up Sussex way.
Down Sussex way.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's been sort of deep and crisp and even. What? That's a snow joke.
I know it's a snow joke. Right, isn't it?
And it's been super nice.
And for New Year's, where are you going to be?
New Year's, back in London. Mutual friend of ours, Mr. Ben Rawlinson Plant, is doing a bash. He's emigrating next year.
Where's he going?
As well he might.
Where's he going?
To New York City. So ooh. He's going to have one last dust up. In King's Cross. What?
I think that's it might good. Be full on.
Yeah, I think it'll be a fun one. So that's good. What about you chaps? What's happening for what's New Year's
Eve?
Well,
if you're in the first hour of the program, I think most of our listeners already are. But no, New Year's Eve.
Have you been invited?
Yeah, actually, we didn't do this one. No, you're right. We were recapping Christmas. So there's a couple of options. I'm thinking I'm going to head back to Italy after this program, and I am thinking Maybe Bad Gastein.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah. So that's about 2.5 hour drive up from Murano. And we had some really nice people at the conference who have a lovely hotel there. And so I'm thinking that could be lovely. So maybe, I don't know, 2 days up there.
So this is one of those beautiful photogenic hotels where you feel like you might be Grand Budapest territory.
Yeah, we covered them in The Escapist. Yeah. Amazing properties.
Yeah, and it's quite abandoned town. I forget like how many empty beds. Like there's a variety of properties. And it was quite
take some friends.
Exactly. You bring 1,000 of your closest.
Yeah.
So I might do that. But you know, I just might hang out at home as well. I'm not sure. Anyway, but it'll be lovely regardless. Andrew,
it's going to involve a slipper, it sounds like.
Listen, you know, whether it's Bad Gastein, also say it a few times. It sounds like something that might happen after Big New Year's Eve out,
doesn't it? Yeah. You need a bit of slipper after that.
I've got a couple of options. I might be down in Wiltshire with friends who've got a nice house.
You've done that
house.
Before.
Yeah, I like that. And it's
slipper involved
good.
As well.
You slipper involved, whoa. Dog can go.
Right.
Boozy country people. It's very nice.
Speak for yourself, Andrew.
I know. I like a farmer who can knock back a few, as they say. And, but
give
I
it,
might.
Give it some welly.
I might be tempted to come back to London because I'm away in the countryside quite a lot between Christmas and New Year.
Yeah. Right. It's good.
What would London involve?
Well, I have a very nice friend who has a very nice house on the river out narrow streetish way.
Indeed. Mm-hmm.
And I potentially might head there.
All right. So watching fireworks and all.
We tried that last year. You look and you can see like something on the horizon that looks like
what?
A Bad Gastein fart going off. Is that, that's about as good as it gets.
Oh my goodness.
We've come full circle. I think we've come full circle. I feel like we've really upped the ante in the last 10 minutes of this programme.
That's the cheese and that's all the wine.
Yeah.
All in Studio One.
All in Studio One. Bill Lawrence, by the way,
fantastic.
Wonderful to come in after him. Absolutely amazing.
Now, I thought that We Three Kings was brilliant.
And again, it reminds us of the early days of when we used to do these Christmas shows in that huge studio in Covent Garden.
I know.
And we had, we need to mix it up and get it back.
I know.
Get
I,
it
well,
back
yeah. there. I think we can probably tell our listeners we've got quite a few plans for this little station of ours next year. And I think, Andrew, one thing we have talked about is, we did some rather ambitious things before we built studios and everything, thinking back to being down at the hospital. So I think a bit of live, and I don't know whether we're talking sort of quarterly or maybe it won't be monthly to start, but I think there's a couple of interesting things we're planning in the form of the Listening Club, and people probably hear a little bit more about that as it's tied to our 10th anniversary, but it's something for all of you dear listeners, I think particularly at this time of year.
Yeah, don't mention the 10th anniversary. We're going to have to lie down now with all the things that we've got to do for that.
a lot of things to do. And do you think we gave our readers enough of a teaser before we ship the February issue off, knowing that big things are a-coming?
Oof. Yeah, so 10th anniversary, it will be our 101 issue. It comes out in the middle of February. And for the first time, we're kind of playing a little bit around with the format, refreshing a few things.
Mm.
Risorgimento.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, it's more than refreshing a few things. It's like... It's actually just like the whole thing went into a clinic in Bad Gastein.
It's not brushing the teeth, is it? It's got a new. It's going to come out with one of those kind of bruises on its nose. Possibly a little bit of rhinoplasty has taken place.
But firm of buttock, I think.
Firmer of
absolutely.
Plump of thigh. Yeah.
Well, Jim, I think we should probably abandon the mics and turn it over to our other colleagues who'll be looking after our listeners throughout the rest of the day. Andrew, have a very Merry Christmas.
Thank you, and you too, sir.
Thank you, Bobby Bound.
Thank you, Tyler. Merry Christmas to you.
Are you scampering back down to Sussex? Is that the car?
Off I hop.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that the
car's idling
is that
the driveway.
Is that the Volvo idling outside?
Exactly.
That is all for this 390th edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall. Our researchers were Alexa Sogol and Helena Geriat. And our studio manager was the very, very lovely Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will be back next week. What's it going to be? It's going to be a look ahead, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
It is going to be a look ahead.
Just the whole of 2017.
That's all of 2017. But for now, it's a very happy Christmas from me, Tyler Brulé.
And happy Christmas from me, Andrew Tuck.
Merry Christmas from me, Robert Bound.
Goodbye.